Hello and welcome back to Happy Porch Radio, the circular economy technology podcast. I'm Emily.
And I'm Barry.
This is the second episode of our Exploring Circular Tech Fashion Resale mini-series deep dive. In the last episode, we started off by setting the scene, looking at the colossal negative impact of the linear system, the importance of finding circular solutions in the fashion world, the undeniable growth of re-commerce in this sector. And we started to explore some of the opportunities and the challenges of re-commerce for stakeholders such as brands, the users of these platforms, and then also the broader world and the society we live in.
We started from the assumption that re-commerce is having a positive circular impact on the linear fashion system. And then we explored how complex that is, how difficult to prove that is, how it varies between different models, different types of apparel, and we started to explore the real complexities there. Emily, what are we doing in this episode?
This episode is all about looking at how re-commerce is working in practice right now, which is actually trickier to look at than it sounds because it's such a fast-moving and dynamic space that taking a sort of snapshot of what now looks like is almost useless. Why would we do that when it's changing so much so quickly?
It's also exciting, though, to explore some of what's happening right now, the beginnings of where this could go, some of the challenges, and talk to some of the amazing people about some of the amazing work that's happening.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see what the cutting edge of this re-commerce world looks like. And also to think about those challenges that came up in episode one, the complexities that we looked at, and talk to some of the people that are working in this space and to see how they're approaching those challenges.
In episode one, we talked about the different types of marketplaces. And to help us explore that further, we spoke to Joe Metcalf, who is founder of Thrift Plus. Thrift Plus is one of the UK's largest resale services, and they've sold over 1 million pre-loved items so far. Joe highlighted the different experiences for buyers and sellers on a managed marketplace like theirs.
Rather than a peer-to-peer marketplace like Vinted or eBay, where they just provide the platform to connect buyers and sellers, but otherwise the sellers are doing all of the work of taking photographs and uploading and pricing all the items and posting. We're a managed marketplace, so we sit right in the middle. We have a warehouse and we have operations and we handle every single item that's listed on the marketplace. And so that helps both sides of the equation. It helps our sellers because they don't need to take any photographs at all. They just put all of their items into a bag and send them to us. But it also helps our shoppers as well, because rather than just buying single individual items from a person on the other side of the country, you can now shop kind of quite similarly to normal e-commerce, where you're putting 5, 8, 10 items into your basket, getting them all dispatched at the same time from our warehouse in the next couple of days. You've also got 30-day returns and a great customer service team as well.
As with all the marketplace models we mentioned in episode one, there are pros and cons to a managed marketplace. But according to Joe, Thrift Plus is actually targeting a whole different audience, a different type of seller.
We actually don't see ourselves as a competitor to Vinted, really. I think anyone who is considering selling on Vinted or eBay and who is happy to spend their time taking photos of clothes and going to the post office, and lots of people really, really enjoy that process. It's kind of the kind of entrepreneurial thrill of making money and selling and getting the sales and dealing with buyers, that kind of thing. If you are a Vinted user and you enjoy using Vinted, you should continue using Vinted. You will get all of the sale back. So we're for everyone who doesn't want to be doing that. And I don't know the exact stats, but I would say the majority, 60, 70% of the UK do not spend their weekends taking photos of their old clothes. So from the seller perspective, that's the real kind of magic of a service like ours, which is that just pure simplicity of putting items into a bag. And it's actually why we present it on that side of the equation as a wardrobe clear out service. So maybe you still are selling one or two items that still have their tags on, or you bought for £80 or an unwanted present. You can still sell those individual items because it's worth your while. But if you've got 10, 20, 30, 50 items coming out of your wardrobe, each may be only worth £5 or £10 resale. It just becomes an overwhelming task and not really worth your time.
The cool thing about what Joe is describing here is we're starting to see how some of the challenges we raised in episode one can be resolved by the different marketplace approaches. Peer-to-peer marketplaces can have a huge audience and a very specific type of benefit and can actually be fun for the both buyers and sellers. What Joe is describing here has got the potential to grow the sector even more. allowing people to transition to resale, as he says, in a very simple way. The other thing I like is that we talked in episode one about how resale, one of the core benefits is pricing for the buyer and an opportunity to make some or all of your money back from the purchase as a seller. But now we're also exploring with Joe some of the other benefits he talks about, wardrobe clear out and the simplicity of it as other benefits for the users that he's engaging with.
Yeah, the wardrobe clear out service also feels like just a clever way to market another resale platform, you know, like it offers another benefit right there in the tagline. But the service that Thrift Plus offers is actually optimizing the experience for buyers as well as sellers. Thanks to all the work of Joe and his team, there's not only sort of good pictures and all of the stuff's been sorted through, so you know, like this, there's sort of been quality control, but there's also going to be a returns policy, and you know that there's a customer service behind what you're doing, which you lack quite often in the peer-to-peer platforms.
We've also talked about how the linear retail fashion system is hugely optimized. There's a range of different places and options to buy for every different type of person. So what's interesting about what Joe's describing is starting to look at how within resale we can explore the optimization process for different types of audiences.
Unsurprisingly though, all the work that goes into managing a managed marketplace can be quite a lot.
We are handling about 100,000 items a month. We upload about 45,000 items. And that means everything from opening the bag, identifying the brands, quality controlling every single item, taking the photographs, capturing the data, all of the tech behind that, which is to create the listings. We list across our own app and website, but also onto eBay. We're one of the biggest sellers of secondhand on eBay. And then all of the actual operations. Most e-commerce is built around individual items, but you have 10, 20, 100 of those items in different sizes and different colors. We have one of every item. Single SKU inventory is a real challenge. And so all of our tech and all of our operations is built around every single item being unique, which is another really interesting challenge to solve.
Yeah, all that work that is put in by thousands of individual sellers on a peer-to-peer marketplace is being done by one team in the Thrift Plus model. And that is incredibly labor intensive.
And so from a technology perspective, that's an interesting and fun and challenging problem. The linear economy has optimized these problems, and we have processes and tools and systems in place to really streamline everything. And what Joe and his team are starting to do is explore how to do that with this whole different model, whereas he says everything's unique.
I guess it really varies so much on like the price of the item that is being sold. If you have a quick look at the Thrift Plus website, you can see something like a handbag for 500 quid. So in that case, when you're thinking about everything that's going into selling that handbag, you know, the sorting of it, photographing it, listing it, the quality control checks and everything that happen. And then also, obviously, a percentage of how much it's sold for goes to the original seller. You can understand how selling something for 500 quid, get a bit of a margin on that. But there's also things that are selling for like £4.50. So the work that's going into a £4.50 item is the same work that's going into a £500 item. And from a business perspective, that just doesn't seem viable.
It makes me think about how in the linear economy, those cheap, mass-produced, lower end of the price point, how it's only possible for that to be cheap for two reasons. One, because we're ignoring huge externalities, external costs. And two is because they're doing the same thing millions of times. And so that's very different to what we're describing here. So there's a whole new model to be built.
Yeah, so the question is, how are they making the numbers work? And how is technology supporting that?
The thing that we've been working hard on for the last 7 years, and the thing that we've needed to solve, is the relatively unsexy part right in the middle. It's the engine. It's effectively a maths problem, which is, can we process these clothes, this clothing, at low enough cost, and can we sell a high enough percentage of what we're processing for a high enough price that the numbers all work? And that's a really hard problem to solve, especially when you're a little bit too small, or especially when you're moving warehouse or you're scaling. So the tech is a really big part of that. Effectively, we've built that there's kind of two big chunks of tech which help support that. One is the actual app, we call it our ops app, the app that our team uses in the warehouse, It's run on Android phones, and we have about 60 team members in our warehouse in Market Harbor who are using our app to continuously capture the data from items. It then interacts with the photography booths that we've built to capture that data as efficiently as possible. And a lot of that so far has just been a kind of process flow challenge. We actually haven't yet integrated the likes of AI and computer vision, because the biggest gains so far have been around improved handling, improved quality control, improved efficiency of just handling the items themselves. But we're getting on to that, the more exciting stuff, soon. And then the other big chunk of tech is, what do we do with that data once we've captured it? So that would include the automated pricing algorithm that we use, the automated discounting curve after that point to help the items sell. And then the listing of, we currently have, I think, 400,000 items listed across both our website and our app, but also across eBay. And so that challenge of syncing that inventory in almost real time across multiple sales channels is also a unique challenge that our tech enables as well.
As a software engineer and as an enthusiast for the role of technology and circularity, I get really excited about that unsexy middle, as Joe calls it. Not getting caught up in the buzzwords and the coolest technology, but actually genuinely trying to work out how to solve the problem. And as he said, the biggest gains is in just optimizing the physical movement of goods. In the linear economy, we've had decades and decades to optimize the movement of goods around and exactly streamline the processes and build the perfect tech and manage processes around that. What Joe's doing here is exploring a whole new model and inventing that and building the technology that he needs to make it work. I think that's incredibly exciting. And then, as he said, we start to look at some point, the buzzwords of technology, AI and computer vision and the stuff that on top of that, that can add multiplier and scaling effects, but only with that solid foundation. And as technologists, sometimes we can forget that.
I find that interesting as well, because as a non-technologist, I think that there's this assumption that what's going to, quote unquote, save the world are like these brand shiny new AI and like super clever technology things, right? That the new tech is the thing that's going to save the world, is the thing that's going to change the system, whatever. But what changes the system is changing the system. And that means like going, as you say, to the foundational level of what are the basic things we're doing. And I think that that's really interesting as a metaphor for other kind of change and sort of building solutions as well.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I'm really inspired by what people like Joe are doing. They're doing this process reinvention, this system change within the huge momentum that our existing linear system has. And therefore, he needs scale to be financially sustainable.
We aren't yet profitable overall as a business, but for the last 3 months, we have finally got the math to work so that we are now generating contribution from our operations. So the operations itself is contributing £30,000-£40,000 towards our overheads. And so we need to be about 3 or 4 times bigger in order to cover our overheads. And we expect to be there by the end of the year. A lot of challenges to get there, but that's a real, real milestone for us to have 3 consecutive months where we're making money on every item effectively. And we just now need to process more items to get to that break-even point. And once we're there, then as we scale, things kind of just get better and better because we can invest in automation. We can have a larger warehouse. We can get an efficiencies of scale. We can have a much better place for people to come and shop directly on our site because the inventory is much better and broader. And some of those, again, those numbers get better in different ways. Actually, the supply side is the bit that needs to be unlocked because there is enormous demand for secondhand, but we need to get good quality supply up on these platforms so that it can meet the demand that's already there. And so that's our focus right now, is really unlocking the supply side and then working in partnership with the big peer-to-peer platforms and getting our supply onto those platforms.
I think that's really great that Thrift Plus are defying the odds like that, and they're on track towards becoming profitable. But it does make me feel like a model that relies so heavily on scale, as Joe described, like, can they afford to have any competitors?
I think that's a really interesting question. And there's 2 things in that question I'd like to reflect on. One is, you said defying the odds, and I would describe what Joe and these other platforms and innovators are doing is that they're innovating. They're creating the system change that we're talking about. They're creating new business models. This is a recurring theme across circularity in all sectors. and those building on the new processes and the new tech to enable that circularity, they're often faced with two challenges. One is making their own businesses viable and succeed, but then the other one is they're inventing a process. Unlike the equivalent for a linear retail business, they know what the processes are, they just need to work out how to position it and brand it and find their own identity and make their own business viable. So they have one big problem. Circular businesses have two big problems. And then the real strength of competition in that is that we need those things to succeed. We need overlapping competition in the right way to inspire and work towards each other. We need the size of the pie to grow. Resale is growing, and we need it to grow more, and we need it to grow in the right way. So there's this, again, complexity. There's this really difficult, complex thing of straddling between reinventing the system, trying to make a business viable and successful and scale, and handling things like the balance between competition and collaboration. As he said, he's working, he uses the peer-to-peer platforms as one of his distribution channels. I mean, it's just this big, messy, complex, difficult problem. And that's, I think, what's so inspiring about Joe and the other folks innovating in this space.
Yeah, that collaboration between Thrift Plus and eBay is really smart. That's where everyone already is. So that feels like a really good example of what you were just describing, Barry, of that like crossover, collaboration meets competition ways of working. It was also interesting what Joe said about unlocking the supply side. To me, there was almost a contradiction there because eagle-eared listeners will have heard that Thrift Plus receive 100,000 items a month, but they actually only list 45,000 a month. So what is happening to the other 55,000 items?
There's a metric that is critical to our business, which is the sell-through rate, the percentage of the items that we upload that go on to sell. That's really important for our business because we're putting labor cost into every single item. So if an item doesn't sell, the cost of processing the item has to be borne by all those that do. So it's critical for our business. It's actually not that critical for peer-to-peer businesses because there's no labor going into it. There's no paid labor going into that. So quality is really important for that. We simply can't afford to upload brands with low sell-through. So we can't at the moment afford to upload H&M or M&S or Primark or any of the supermarket brands because an H&M jumper, you know, compared to those peer-to-peer platforms, we're not doing too badly. I think we sell 1 in 3 of the jumper, 30-something percent sell-through of an H&M jumper. But that means we have to pay about £2 an item to process 3 jumpers for every 1 H&M jumper we actually sell for about £4.50. So we just lose money. And so that's kind of what I meant at the start when I say this is a maths problem, because every single brand or every single brand and item type we could look at and say, okay, what's the sell-through and what's the average selling price and how much is it costing us? And by bringing the cost of processing the item down and down and down, we can upload more items and the numbers work on more brands and more item types. So that's the 55,000. It's either brands we can't accept or items that aren't clean or in good enough condition or items that are unbranded. Interestingly, even great stuff, which is unbranded, doesn't sell online because people aren't searching for it and can't find it. So that's the difference, and that's the assessment we're making based on a lot of data, but then on a kind of manual quality control as well.
So because of the filtering process that Joe describes and the smart pricing and other intelligent parts of their process, the sell-through rate on Thrift Plus is around 70%, which Joe tells us is much higher than in most peer-to-peer networks. So they've learned what does and doesn't tend to sell well. And one of the interesting things is how that ties back to in episode 1, we talked about displacement rate being different for different types of goods. The report that Andy and JR described where they broke apparel into different sections and the cheaper end of the apparel market really struggles in resale.
Yeah, so as Joe mentioned, Thrift Plus just doesn't list really low margin items. So what about those items that get sent to Thrift Plus but don't get listed, or the items that do get listed but don't sell, that 30% that don't sell? There's a question about all that optimization that ensures that their sell-through rate is 70%. How much is that potentially sacrificing some of their impact when it comes to the waste that is being generated?
Thrift Plus do the best they can with those goods, donating to charity and finding responsible recycling and so on, which is obviously still better than the alternative. But really that does, to me, point to the wider system problems. Again, the problems we're describing in the linear fashion system. And potentially, again, points to some of the real challenges with the fast fashion, low quality, low price end of the market. essentially, is it Joe's responsibility to be solving that problem? Or should we be looking across the whole system? Actually, it's more than just quality and price. He talked about on-branded goods being hard to sell, which is where the real value of a brand identity comes in, and the real opportunity for brand-owned resale comes in, for example. Another angle that I'm really interested in is incentives. There is a cost for Thrift Plus to have items that don't sell. Same on brand-owned resale, where there's a warehousing problem and so on. On peer-to-peer marketplaces, that problem is spread out to the seller. It's less impactful on a peer-to-peer marketplace if there's things on there that don't sell, and they might be more incentivized to have a wider range, including things that maybe don't sell very quickly. All of that just points to the complexity that we keep coming back to.
Yeah, as we mentioned at the beginning here, there are pros and cons to all these different models of platform. And where this managed marketplace system might fall down, a peer-to-peer platform might be able to fill that hole. So there is a real need for all different kinds of models working in synchronicity and kind of like an ecosystem of re-commerce.
We've talked about the pros and cons of the different types of marketplaces. And one of the challenges, especially for peer-to-peer, is finding what you're looking for. And so often, unless you're one of the converted, or you have the time, or you have another incentive to actually go through and search and find, you'll find the perfect item and then it's not available in your size or your color, or you don't quite trust the photographs or whatever. It's a real problem that some people are looking at how to address.
When Jessica Potter and her partner Davey set up Used and Loved, that was one of the problems that they were trying to solve.
I came up with the idea for Used and Loved one night before I was going to sleep, and I have ADHD, so I have a lot of inventions. And this was one of them. I wrote it down because I was really struggling with buying everything that we wanted secondhand for our baby. And the reason that we were buying everything secondhand for our baby was because we wanted it to have as little impact on the planet as possible. But I realized there was so much friction and so many barriers stopping even me from wanting to do it, even though I was so committed. So I thought, if there was all this friction and barriers, that must mean that millions of other parents are just giving up at the first hurdle. And I thought, what's the point of us, you know, trying to do this for our one baby if it's just not going to have an impact at all? So my dream was bring all the different secondhand websites into one place and make it easier for people to search secondhand.
There are various platforms that lie on a spectrum of what they offer. On one end, you've got the eBays and the Amazons that literally you can find anything that you're looking for. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got platforms that have got a real niche. They're very specific or maybe brand owned. So if you know exactly what you're looking for, you can go there. But then in the middle, there's quite a lot of like more generalist platforms, and they simply may not have the quantity of listings to help you find what you need.
So Used and Loved's approach feels like an intuitively sensible solution to that problem, a search engine for the secondhand marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
But Jessica's journey shows us that this can be a hard business to build.
Then I realized that it's really challenging because it's not really a big enough problem for people. And actually, when I came up with the idea, this was like 6 years ago, so things have changed now. You know, there's so many more people selling stuff on Facebook Marketplace and Vinted and eBay and Gumtree. So it's not as much of a problem anymore, but there still is a problem that it's still just not easy enough.
It's the window shopping thing, right? Browsing is part of the joy of shopping for a lot of people. And when the browsing just becomes overwhelming because there's so much stuff, and it's not all really relevant to you or your interests, then it just turns you off. Like, you don't want to do that necessarily.
It appeals to different people, as you said. I hate browsing and hate window shopping. And for that reason, I find buying secondhand, even though I'm really motivated, like Jessica describes, I find it hard work.
Mm.
And so this is a genuine problem. And many of the platforms are trying to solve this in different ways. Jessica's talking about optimizing the finding experience. And we've talked to other technology providers who are like Thrift Plus, who are trying to simplify the quality and the clarity of everything for everybody. So it's part of that broader, how do we optimize the re-commerce process in order for it to reach the same scale as our current linear model?
And with the re-commerce world changing so quickly at the minute, such a like fast evolving space, that Jessica's story shows how difficult it can be for startups or for innovations to actually sort of find a routing and make their mark. You know, we talked last time about how much this space is growing. Stats for people who like them. Vinted's user base more than doubled from 30 million to 65 million in the 3 years from 2019 to 2022. And, you know, that's just one platform. Other platforms have had similar levels of growth. And somebody sort of like starting new, a newcomer to the space, has to keep up with that. So the problem that that newcomer might have started out to solve might not even be there by the time they actually get their feet off the ground.
Startups are hard. Startups in system reinvention, like we're trying to do with Circularity, are even harder. I find Jessica's passion and her motivations and her conviction to trying to contribute to the solutions in this area to be very inspiring. And like any smart startup founder, Jessica's learning and starting to pivot and adapt.
Over the first year of it being live, we started playing around with creating suggested categories. So for women's vintage fashion, for example, we found really nice like editorial stock pictures of like a woman in a vintage gingham dress, for example. So you could see a really cool picture of a woman wearing a really cool vintage gingham dress. And then you click on that and it shows you all the vintage gingham dresses. Basically, the biggest problem that I realized is that when you buy new, you don't really need to know what you're looking for. You can just browse. But with secondhand, you need to know what you're looking for. You can't really discover and browse the same way. So it's really restricted to people that know what they want. And a lot of people that spend a lot of money on fashion aren't really those kind of people necessarily. So we started building out all of these different categories. So we've got like sports, like running shoes, like horse equipment, like all loads of stuff. But I realized that actually there are so many experts that already exist on Instagram and Facebook and places like that and TikTok where they know how to style secondhand. They are advocating for buying secondhand, not new. They show people like what their life looks like with them wearing these super cool outfits.
Yeah, we're just seeing more evolutions of the industry. Like this time, it's the rise of secondhand influencers, which in part is like filling that niche that Jessica's solution was looking to address. But she realized that there was still a problem that needed a solution.
You've got all of the influencers of new that are doing that, and they are financially rewarded for doing that by getting affiliate marketing from, you know, Zara or whoever. You have an influencer wearing an outfit, the top was from this place, here's the link, and the trousers were from this place, here's the link. And those items will be available, like hundreds of thousands of them, however many, until they're sold out. But with secondhand, you can't do that. You know, there's just like one item of that specific thing. You can't, unless that person was selling that one item, you can't buy that exact thing. So I thought, why don't we combine the advanced tech for influencer technology, basically, for secondhand fashion, and then we can really bridge that gap and really change the way people experience buying secondhand. So with our tech, it would be similar items available. So if someone was an influencer was wearing like a black and white polka dot dress and red kitten heels or whatever it might be, then that's what our search results would show, would be similar black polka dot dresses and similar red kitten heels. So they would never be the exact items. Because that was still quite an early stage of the pilot, I don't know fully whether that would be really adopted by everyone, because it's a completely different way of shopping, you know, to like see the person's outfit that you really love. And then actually you just need to then still apply some imagination to like see how this other polka dot dress that's like a different cut and a different style potentially. So the tech really needs to be enhanced with pulling out those hidden listings, basically, to be able to get the best matches.
It sounds like the business that Jessica has today is very different to where she started several years ago, a bit like Andy, who we heard from last episode. She told us that the pilot is going really well for this new approach, but she is aware that the landscape is still changing. Evolution will continue.
I'm really inspired by the work that Jessica and Davey have been doing over the years, building technology to solve a difficult problem while learning and adapting and pushing against our recurring theme of the huge momentum of the linear economy. They're really trying to disrupt the current stranglehold on linear and fast fashion. And as Jessica points out, currently influencer marketing is incentivized away from resale. And so maybe Used and Loved can help shift that. I love that Jessica and Davy are not wedded to technical implementation, but they're wedded to the mission, the goal that they're trying to reach. However, like Jo, she recognises the challenging parameters in which resale operates and the ways in which fashion and e-commerce are perhaps inherently set up to favour brand new.
It is really hard. So secondhand clothes and everything else are a lot cheaper than new. So there's already like a big gap in how much money there is available to make money from. And then the affiliate money that you make is just not much. You know, you have to have high volumes for it to be really worth it. So one thing that we are potentially going to look into doing is having like a membership or like just something where it's like a club that people can join and like really immersive secondhand world, basically. But it's really challenging. There are lots of ways that you can monetize once you have like a big community, but that means you have to get patient investors, which are hard to come by. You know, like investors have so much choice of companies that are just making money really fast, you know, really quickly. It just takes time, which costs money. And then we need money, but we need investors to appreciate that it's just a longer road, basically.
All of this, the dynamics of the fast-growing market, the innovation and invention around circular solutions, all of this is really hard to navigate, not just for newcomers like Used and Loved, but also for those that have been in this industry potentially for decades and now find themselves in a new evolving ecosystem, the brands. Let's talk about the brands.
As we talked about in the last episode, a big and growing part of the re-commerce ecosystem is now brand-led. And when brands engage in circularity and re-commerce, they're likely to be working with technology companies that can support them. Many of these operate on a resale as a service model. That may include software, maybe plugging into Shopify or their existing e-commerce platforms. It may also include supporting services, handling the physical clothes, or tying into repair or other services. In the last episode, we heard from Andy at Trove, which is one such company.
Another and even newer addition to the market is Recurate, which likewise helps brands leverage resale opportunities. We spoke with Recurate's co-founder, Wilson Griffin, about why brands need this support and what it can offer them.
The way the brands are organized as far as how they run their e-commerce business, for example, brands tend to create a collection and then merchandise that collection on their website. And usually what they're doing is, you know, posting those items available for sale. And then there's a lot of depth behind that item. What I mean is maybe there's, you know, a product available for sale on the site, but behind the scenes, we know that the brand has an inventory of 10,000 of that item, and same with every item in that collection. So they're really good at producing multiples of one product or a collection of products. What our software does is we create unique listings because every secondhand listing is in some way unique. It's either in a different location, maybe there's a slight flaw with it or a stain, or maybe it's been repaired in some way that makes it different from, you know, every other product. Brands aren't good at that because it's not how they're built. They're not good at creating unique one-of-one listings that can be purchased. So that is really sort of what our software does. One of the key capabilities that we have is if you, Emily, are going to list a product for sale and you say it's in very good condition, you've worn it three times, or whatever other information, you know, we have ways through our software to attach that kind of data to that product, to that listing, so we can surface it to a potential buyer. And that's something that brands aren't great at. You know, that's really where software like ours can help brands manage resale, whether it's people selling peer-to-peer, or offering take-back or repair, whatever it might be. So sort of that suite of solutions all falls within our software.
Existing e-commerce platforms and stock control and product tracking and all the software that the linear retail in fashion relies on aren't designed with the situation Wilson describes that would support resale and repair and returns and all of the associated things. And so just like Joe at Thrift Plus, specialists like Recurate or Trove are solving these problems, are filling these gaps. And because they're focused specifically on this, with circularity at the core, they're able to rethink the technology and creatively innovate to improve the resale shopping experience, both for the brands and for buyers and sellers.
Yeah, everyone we've spoken to for this series mentioned how emerging technologies might evolve this even further. Who knows what the future might look like? Wilson had some exciting ideas.
I think that there's also opportunities with things like image recognition tools and AI to make it easier for people to list items. You know, for example, we can create most of a listing just by leveraging data from the brand's catalog. I think in the not too distant future, someone would maybe take two images of that product and we could use artificial intelligence to build out the rest of that listing as far as what condition it's in, making that image look better with some software tools in the background to, you know, improve the lighting, put it on a plain background, that sort of thing. I think that there's probably some predictive intelligence that we could start to leverage in the future, especially when we start to talk about inventory levels and things like that, where a brand sells out a product and then they want to reach into their previous customers' closets and, you know, sell those products in the event that they can. I think that we'll probably get to a point where there's enough data that we can actually see those things happening in real time. And that if a brand launches a product and it's incredibly successful and they realize that, you know, we're going to sell out of this product, maybe they actually start to reach out to the previous owners preemptively so that the brand's never actually out of stock. You know, prices are kind of changing dynamically and the brands are keeping those products in circulation at a price that makes sense. I think that those tools will emerge as well. I feel very strongly that we're in the early stages of how technology and software can enable more participation in the circular economy. And then, of course, you know, to do so in a way that brands and retailers are at the center of it and driving that behavior. I am very optimistic that there's going to be more developments in the future that are going to improve the experience for customers and the way that brands are able to utilize these tools.
I really like Recreate's mission here. As we've said, because they're focused on the circularity aspect, they're able to look at what are the innovations, what are the exciting potentials that they've already got in their software and that could potentially be coming in the future. And like everybody else we've spoken to, they're creating the process and this ecosystem as they go. Recreate have some wonderful resources, which we'll share in the show notes, including an ebook, Circular Solutions for Brands and Retailers, that I think emphasizes this point. And I get really excited about this recurring idea that the technology with the right mindset and the right mission behind it can be part of this broader solution.
This conversation with Wilson really kind of like set my imagination running wild. Obviously, it brought to mind the Clueless closet and made me wonder why we don't have that yet. You know the Clueless closet, Barry?
No.
1990s iconic film Clueless, where main character Cher has a closet that has a display and she can just flick through a whole wardrobe on a like image of her and she can see what she wants to wear that day. Why don't we have that yet? But it also made me think about this idea of like a world in which the data from your social media accounts was shared with resale platforms and you might get a little notification that's like, oh, that nice summer dress that you bought 3 years ago, you haven't worn since last August. Maybe you want to sell it. It could go for this much money. Or like somebody else even could be like, oh, I really like that dress. I wonder if they're reselling it and get in touch. That kind of freaks me out, but it's just my imagination running wild of like where this technology could take us. So many opportunities.
Setting aside the privacy concerns of somebody scanning my social media accounts.
Yeah, it is pretty scary.
You're absolutely right, though. There is real exciting potential for the future of this, and we don't know where that's going to go. Wilson talked about some ideas that aren't far away from what they're already doing. We also haven't explored digital passports and the opportunities that that opens up for brands and for tracking and for this, particularly in resale. And there's so much more there. And all of this opens the even more complex relationship between the physical and the digital worlds. And that's something that Wilson is also excited by.
Another thing that we've given some thought to is connecting experiences to products, meaning is there a scenario where, you know, you have access to online content or it's going to a concert or whatever it might be, and that access is actually attached to, you know, a physical item that you own. And, you know, what does that mean for resale value going forward? I think that there's the connection between sort of the digital world and the physical world is only going to get closer in the coming years. And I think that will have a role on circularity and resale as we think about sort of what these products are worth. And it could be more than just the actual experience of wearing them. It could be more attached to it than that.
For me, that is a really key point and ties back to our conversation about resale being more than just price driven and our mindset of our relationship with our clothing changing.
Yeah, I think it brings us back to some like really big questions that kind of zooms us out from the technology. How are we using what we have? How are we valuing what we have? How are we interacting with the other people in our community and what they have? Like they're sort of like huge fundamental questions in which technology can be incredibly useful tools to find more positively impactful ways of doing those things. But I think looking at those big questions is an integral part of also understanding how we use the technology.
And I feel really positive about the role that everybody we've spoken to this episode and our previous episode. For them, circularity is a first-class citizen, enabling them to think about the technology as a driver for change. They're actively looking at the ecosystem and their role building a successful business within that, balancing all the complexities that we've talked about. So, Emily, where are we after two episodes of this deep dive?
We're in deep, Barry. We're in really deep. And I'm enjoying it. You know, we came in with this question, is re-commerce currently, as it stands, is it a force for good? Is it having a positive impact?
And the answer, unsurprisingly, I guess, is sometimes and maybe.
It depends.
There's a major risk that re-commerce is distracting or hiding some deeper problems. So, for example, is it enabling us to buy lots of new stuff because, hey, it's okay, I can resell it, when in actual fact, we're barely moving the needle in this wider system change? But there's also clear signs that with the right mindsets and the right approach and the right thinking, that it can be positive impact on so many of the problems and that people can build successful, thriving businesses within resale.
Yeah, we've spoken about many different models of what resale can look like and talked about the pros and cons of each. And I don't think we want anyone to take away from this that there's like a best way of doing it and a worst way of doing it. There are just ways of like optimizing all of those models. But actually, the important thing is the contribution of all of those models. It's like a yes and everything, everywhere, all at once. And with that, we inherently understand that everything comes with the cons as well as the pros. But it's not actually helpful, in my opinion, to fixate on the issues that re-commerce could present, because the reality of the alternative of like not pursuing re-commerce is always going to have vastly more negative impact. It's like, yes, we know that there are problems with re-commerce models of all variations, but what we're choosing is stepping into the problems that we can see, the problems that we acknowledge, but stepping away from this huge, vast, global problem that comes with the linear system.
Exactly. And perhaps, despite the fact that we've focused solely on re-commerce for this mini-series, we have to acknowledge the fact that this is part of an overall system change to more circularity. One aspect of that that's really intriguing is the idea of resale being a gateway to some of those other changes. So, for example, for a brand, resale could be an immediate benefit, as Cynthia talked about last episode, for handling things like discards and damaged goods in a warehouse, or a different way to think about relationships with the customers, or a different income stream for goods once they've passed their first sale. And all of those things have the potential for the brand to start to engage in deeper thinking, in getting physical goods back that affect the design, in rethinking the way their warehouse and their process works, in looking at the broader impact and different ways that they could adapt their model. And the same for users, the buyers and sellers. Maybe that's why resale is growing, because more of us are starting to engage and the technology providers and the solution providers are making it easier for us. So it's a gateway for us to get involved in this. And then we start to rethink the value of our clothes. We start to rethink what ownership means. And for me, that's one of the biggest potentials of resale.
Yeah. And as you say, like, brands can start thinking about these things, partly because they've got leaders, they've got examples to follow, some of whom we've spoken to for this mini series. I just love hearing the way people think about these issues when they're approaching them, like from an entrepreneurial, innovative mindset. They're asking often kind of like the basic questions, but the foundational things, as we've mentioned before, that fundamentally change how we interact with commerce. So, you know, like, who is using this? Who isn't using it yet? And how do we reach those people? And then what are the present issues? And what are the issues of the future? And where can tech take us? But also, what is the change that is happening that isn't technology focused, but it's like happening in parallel with that? And how do we make re-commerce sexy and exciting in the way that buying new things can be like sexy and exciting, you know? I just love the way that the people we've spoken to think about these issues. And as you said, like, even rethinking how we own things and how we value things and what we need and what we don't need. That's like huge changes to be thinking about. And I think it is in good hands.
We've also acknowledged very much that we can't ignore the risks or the downsides. Among the many interesting resources which we'll share in the show notes, there's a really fascinating report recently written by Dennis Pamlin, who's based in Sweden, which is entitled "Secondhand is Currently Bad for Global Sustainability." And he raises in more detail some of the challenges we've highlighted, for example, re-commerce incentivizing more purchasing in some circumstances and distracting us from real change. But what was interesting for me is one of the key points in that report, and Jared and Christina made the same point when we spoke to them for episode one, is how we need to think about resale across the whole sector and across all of our wardrobe, not just the individual items. And for me, we've touched on some of the ways technology allow us to do that, the data gathering, the understanding, the impact, the innovative ways to improve and simplify and optimize and reinvent the system to enable resale and re-commerce to be the success that we want it to be. This has been a deep dive and it's been really fun, and we've explored a topic in much more depth than we've been able to for previous seasons. But yet again, I'm going to say, oh, we've only just scratched the surface.
Mm-hmm.
We scratched a bit deeper than we have in the past, but the more we learn, the more there is to learn and the more exciting potential there is to understand the problems and the challenges and see those with clear eyes, and also to see what is currently being done and what could be done in the future.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Happy Porch Radio. You'll find our show notes at happyporchradio.com, which include links, resources, and much more.
We'll be doing more exploring circular tech topics in the future. So let us know what topics you'd like us to explore. Reach out to hosts@happyporchradio.com.
We want to say a big thank you to all of our guests that joined us for this episode. Their details and contacts are also in the show notes.
I've been Barry.
I've been Emily, and thanks to Ben helping us behind the scenes.
Thanks for listening.
Until next time.